Good evening to each one again. A blessing to be here with you. May God bless you and direct you in your life. Just a minute here to set a few things up, and then I think we'll be ready to get into the message. Okay, those of you, I did a little bit of testing. I know with the lighting and all, I hope this shows up. This has a little more color than some of the ones I try to use in a setting like this. But we'll try to make the best of it tonight. First off, tonight I want to again thank you for your prayers. They always mean a lot. Sometimes you realize how much more you need them than you do other times if you're like me. I spent most of the day working on one message, and about 4:30 the thing just didn't seem like it was going to, just didn't fit, just didn't work. So I started praying rather desperately, and seems like God opened the door on this one for me. It's been something I've worked on quite a bit, and it's not necessarily by itself. I don't know, I think as we go through the week, hopefully we'll answer more questions by itself. It's maybe a little bit unusual. I'll say this about it. The title I have is From Roots to Fruits. And as I speak about this, in a way I'm a little bit coming from a negative aspect. It's something we use in working with people, a certain amount of this. And I want to be clear, there's too often in some of these ways of explaining things, too much emphasis is at times put on the way to explain it, right? There's different ways that God can bring this truth to you. I'm explaining one way that I use that has been a blessing to me personally and to some others I know. The same time in the verses I use, God may give somebody a different explanation, a different way to look at them. And I think where they support Scripture, they help us to understand God's will for us. And also understand ourselves, there's different ways to come at this, and I just want to be clear on that. Okay, from roots to fruits. Sunday, I had the blessing of being here, and visiting with some young men. Let's see if I can find their names here. As I have them here, there was a Kent and a Marty, Isaac, Hans, Richard, Sawyer, Joel, Mark, Kyle, Matthew, I think he was three, he was a little younger than some of the rest, and Ezra. So these young men informed me that they like stories. And so they were telling me stories, at least a few of them did. And so I told them that I would tell some stories especially for them. So you're welcome, boys, to listen to all the stories I say, but I will start off with two for especially you fellows tonight. First of all, the reason for this message, the burden behind this message is I see too many Christians trying to build their Christian life backwards, if you will. And I like to illustrate it this way. As a number of years ago, I knew quite a wealthy man, and he bought a new farm. On this farm, there was an old farmhouse, and he decided that this farmhouse, he walked through it, and he's like, well, I think it's worth salvaging. I can put a renter into it. So he got a crew in, and they put a new roof on this house. Well, as they tore the old shingles off, they discovered that some of the, let's see, make sure I get my thing. I think some of the sheeting was bad, maybe even a few of the trusses, I'm not clear. But as they were doing the process of fixing the roof, they noticed that termites had got into some of the walls and things. So he completed fixing the roof, and then they took part of the walls out after the roof was done, supported it, and fixed the walls and put new siding on it. Well, in the process of fixing the walls and putting new siding on, they discovered that some of the floor joists and stuff were bad, so they had to go underneath and fix that. As I understand it, in the process of fixing the floor joists, they noticed that the foundation wasn't totally supported, so they had to jack the whole thing up and rebuild the parts of the foundation. And his brothers, he had two other brothers we knew fairly well, They always enjoyed giving him a hard time. They called it the house he built upside down. And, you know, that's a hard way to build a house. And it's even a harder way to live the Christian life. It's a hard way to do anything. And so, what do I mean, building the Christian life backwards? This next one's not really, it's an illustration or a story, but it's not the one for you, young men. I have one more for you after this one. So let's explain building the Christian life backwards this way. As a young man, I know very well, who for many years struggled with lustful thoughts and actions. And he tried to have victory. He would try to work on that. He tried to quit having these thoughts. He tried to not let them mature into actions, yet he was unsuccessful. And he actually entered marriage this way. And then, after he'd been married a while, in desperation, partly life pressure, which actually probably was a good thing in this case, he reached out for help. And there was something interesting about that young man. As we tried to help him and sat down and visited with him and what he was facing, he kept saying different things like this. He would say, "I'm pretty sure other people struggle just like I do. I'm just more honest." It was almost, I'm not sure if he said it quite like that, but that's the idea. And there was just different things coming out in his life that to me very clearly showed pride, okay? Just keep that what I told you about that young man, keep that in your thoughts as we go through the rest of this message, and I'll tell you a little more about that later on. Okay, here's a story for the young men again. Okay, there was this farmer. He planted an orchard. Now, I noticed that Oregon planting trees is a thing to do. Now, I don't know if you call these orchard. I think they're hazelnut groves or something. Maybe you got a different name for them. So they're out planting trees, very similar to what's being done around here. And he, being a very wise farmer, I don't know what you call a fellow that keeps an orchard, paid most attention to where he planted his trees. He planted them in the best ground. I think Joel told me these nut trees do the best in the best ground in the valley as well. So he put them in the best ground with proper drainage. Not only that, he did something else. I noticed that at least some of the new plantings around here have mulch around them. Kind of the same principle. He paid much attention to the roots. But he didn't stop. After he had the trees planted, he kept on making sure, paying more attention, if you will, to the roots. Yes, what was above ground was important. It needed pruning, it needed direction, it needed help. But at the same time, he fed the roots. He put fertilizer on it. You know, he mulched it. He kept the weeds out. And so his orchard did very, very well for him. Over the years, the trees matured, began bearing fruit. And as long as he was paying attention to the roots, he had one of the best orchards in the whole area. And everybody was like, "Wow, what are you doing to get this kind of yield from your orchard?" Well, it was pretty simple. He was paying attention to what you could not see so that what you could see would have results. Well, over time, as the story goes, he, being human, started thinking, you know, I've spent all this time, I invested all this thing, surely if it's going pretty well, I shouldn't have to worry about these roots as much anymore. I've gained some ground. So he started not worrying about the roots, not putting quite as much fertilizer on. After all, it was expensive. Not worrying quite so much about what was happening below the ground and enjoying the benefits above the ground a little bit more. You know, it wasn't very many years until those trees started showing evidence above ground that all below ground was not as it had been. I'd like for you to open your Bibles to 1 John chapter 2. 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. We'll read a few verses here. First John chapter 2, verse 15. "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever. There's three phrases in here that I'd like to look at just a bit more. The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life. And there's different ways, like I said earlier, there's different ways to explain or say what was meant. Tonight, I'm going to explain the lust of the flesh as those natural responses to the things I face in life. And later on, I'll be referring to these as the fruit sins. So lust of the flesh, the natural responses to the things I face in life. Anger, discouragement, depression, frustration. And I had some frustration today. For number one, if you think about it, pray for my youngest daughter. Somehow she got fairly congested on us here. And so she woke up throwing up in her bed last night. And somehow, it just was not a way I wanted to start my day. It just really wasn't. The lust of the flesh. The flesh wanted to sleep some more. It wanted to rest. It didn't want to sit up with a fussy little girl. It sure didn't. So that's what we're talking about. We'll get more on that. Okay, the next one is the lust of the eyes. The lust of the eyes I'd like to describe as the natural desires that we tend to give a wrong value and importance. And I'm going to call that the natural desire sins. See, maybe it wouldn't hurt to just move ahead on this a bit. Sometimes I forget to keep this up, and I'll just... Okay, the lust of the eyes, the natural desires that we tend to give a wrong value and importance. Natural desires are, I have a list I'll give you. None of my lists may be totally exhaustive. But think of it this way. One thing that God has put into every one of us, and I may, if Lord wills, get into this one more, is but we all have a certain amount, we desire acceptance from others. And we go about doing that generally in our own way, in false connections to think of last night. The desire for acceptance in and of itself is not wrong, okay? But I generally, as a human being, will try to find acceptance in the wrong way, and maybe a little bit more on that later. Okay, the third phrase, the pride of life. I'd like to think of this as the driving motives of my heart. Those drivers, if I may call them that, those things within my heart that I would never mention and probably even don't like to admit that are in my heart. And I'd like to think of those as root sins. An example of that would be pride. You know, pride makes people do everything from pretending humility to going around boasting and bragging about themselves, spending money they don't have to all kinds of things. All comes from pride. And so as we think of the pride of life as being a root sin, it's below the ground, we often don't like to, we sure wouldn't go tell somebody else they're proud. For example, we often don't admit it to ourselves. I'll go a little bit on the young man I mentioned a while ago. How in the world do you tell a Mennonite he's proud? It's not a fun job. If you don't believe me, try it sometime. It's a good way to lose friends. Very good way. It's something we are taught from, like my one boss used to say, it's from when we're time we're knee-high to a grasshopper to who knows when that we are not to be proud, right? So we spend a lot of energy and time trying to at least make sure we don't look proud for the most part. Growing up in Paraguay, we had a weed. Oh, I hated that, especially that one kind of weed. Because guess what? It had a stalk about this big. It had big green leaves. It'd get about this big. And you could spray for it. Somehow Dad thought that boy labor came cheaper than spray. And somehow spray didn't totally take care of the problem every time either. So guess what I got to do as soon as I was old enough? I would get sent out with a hoe to hoe this stuff out. Now, hoeing this thing was not as simple as just chopping the top of this weed out. If you did that, that thing would be back in a week or two. It didn't take much at all. You actually had to get rid of that root, you couldn't pull it out by hand. It was too stubborn a root for that. But you had to chop the ground up so you could get this root out and then actually toss it out on the grass to where it couldn't grow back into the ground you just had disturbed. That was the matacampo, if that's what we called it anyway. And in a way, that's how these root sins are. Just taking the top off, just taking the evidence, just knocking the fruit off the tree doesn't really fix the problem. This thing just grows another branch, another stalk, and another fruit. You don't need to turn to this, but I'd like, well, you are in 1 John, so you're welcome to flip over there. 1 John chapter 5, verse 14 through 17. A few verses I want to read. 1 John chapter 5, verse 14 through 17. And this is the confidence we have in Him, talking of Christ, or God. If we ask anything according to His will, He, God, heareth us. And we know that He heareth us, whatsoever we ask. He's talking of prayer here. And we know that we have the petitions that we desire of Him, of God. Then he goes on and makes a very interesting statement that we probably could spend a lot more time on than what I will. But he says, if any man see his brother sin a sin which is not unto death, he, I'm taking it this is the man that sees his brother sin, shall ask, and he, God, shall give him, the man that saw this sin and loved his brother enough to pray for him, life for them, the one who sinned, that sinned not unto death. In other words, he has a clarifying phrase, you pray for. If I see my brother sin, a sin that's not unto death, and I'm concerned about him, I go and say, God, brother so-and-so is struggling in this area. Can you just work in his life? Just use me if you can to help him, to bless him. It says God will give me, if, as I pray that prayer, life for that brother, as long as it's not a sin unto death. Then he goes on and says, there is a sin unto death, and I say not that he shall pray for it. In other words, we pray for a sin like that a little bit different. And then he ends up there in verse 17, all unrighteousness is sin, and there is a sin not unto death. Okay, I'm not here. In fact, I have a little bit of a problem with trying to make a list of sins that are unto death and sins that are not unto death. So that's not my plan here. But there's a fascinating thought in this, in that there is a difference given to different types of sin. That in all this, let's never forget the ending phrase there in verse 17, all unrighteousness is sin. What I'm going to share with you tonight is not in any way to minimize or to excuse sin in any shape or form. Notice how that even a sin that is unknown to the person committing it needs a brother or a sister to pray for them so that they can have life. Also, think of this. What does sin do? Can anybody tell me, what does sin do? Any type of sin. It does something just immediately. It builds barriers, right? Sin builds barriers between me and God, between me and you, between God's plan for me. It builds a barrier. And I'm not saying that I feel even a sin that's not unto death, to use those words, builds a barrier. And by another brother praying for me, he may be able to reduce the size of that barrier as long as I'm sincere and still seeking God. Another thing, where does sin lead? All sin, whether big or little, where does it lead? Can anybody tell me again? Does sin lead towards God? Always leads away from God, right? No matter what the type of sin, it puts us on a trajectory away from God, so therefore the need for a brother to pray for me. John 8, verse 34, I'll just read some of these. John 8, verse 34 says, Jesus answered them, verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever committeth sin is a servant of sin. I'd like for you to turn to Galatians chapter 5. Galatians chapter 5, verse 16, and then I'll continue on to chapter 6. I won't make a lot of comments on these verses, but they say fairly clearly what they say on their own. Galatians chapter 5, verse 16. This I say then, walk in the Spirit, and ye shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. For the flesh lusteth against the Spirit, and the Spirit against the flesh, and these are contrary one to another, so that ye cannot do the things that ye would. But if ye be led of the Spirit, ye are not under the law. Now the works of the flesh are manifest, or shown, which in these things, adultery, fornication, uncleanness, lasciviousness, idolatry, witchcraft, hatred, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, seditions, heresies, envyings, murders, drunkenness, revelings, and such like. Of the which I tell you before, as I have told you in time past, that they which do such things shall not inherit the kingdom of God. But the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. And they that are Christ have crucified the flesh with the affections and lusts. If we live in the Spirit, let us also walk in the Spirit. Let us not be desirous of vainglory, provoking one another, envying one another. Brethren, if a man be overtaken in a fault, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness, considering thyself, lest thou also be tempted. Bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. For if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself. But let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone, and not another. For every man shall bear his own burden. Let him that is taught in the word communicate unto him that teacheth in all good things. Be not deceived. God is not mocked. For whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. For he that soweth to his flesh shall of the flesh reap corruption. But he that soweth to the Spirit shall of the Spirit reap life everlasting. There's a certain aspect of how sin works in me, in us, that it can be helpful to fight against the sin as I know how it works. So let's do it this way. I want you to think a little bit here. And I'll warn you, I am being a little bit sarcastic in some of the things I'll say here. Okay, I'd like a raise of hands. This isn't real embarrassing, or at least I'll put mine up first if it is. How many of you have ever been angry in your life, have had a problem with anger? Okay, we've got a lot of people that have a bit of anger in their life, okay? So now think a minute. Do you enjoy that angry feeling? I'm not asking necessarily for a response, just think, do you? Do you wake up in the morning with the thought, if I'm going to be angry today and how I'm going to enjoy it? I just can't wait. I don't know. I was talking with a young man that said he struggled a lot with anger, and he didn't really make it sound like a pleasure. Was yours any different? I tended to agree with him. Okay. So, I just told you that I had some frustration this evening, okay? So, how many of you have ever been frustrated? I gave myself away, right? Anybody felt frustrated? Okay. So, we have some people that struggle with that as well. So, do you get your calendar out and go over the rest of March, go on into April, May, I don't know how far you want to plan, and mark on the day that I'm looking forward to being frustrated on this day? So, and you keep track. Oh, that's just the 2 more days till I can be frustrated. I don't have any problem with doing that. I don't know about you. I think I could guess. Okay. You don't have to raise your hand on this one. But how many of you have been impatient? I tell you what, I don't know. If you don't struggle with impatience, just wait till you're a parent or something. That gives you a good chance to work on that one. That's a wonderful feeling to be impatient, isn't it? You know, there's a section of highway about 15 miles from my house that I drive, not every day, but probably both ways 4 or 5 times a week. And there's a certain time of the day that there's this, and I guess I should stop and meet this person because I've talked about him so much in some of my classes already. They drive a white Chevy Impala, and I have the feeling from what I could catch in the glimpses I've had of them that they're rather old. And the other thing they do that really gets to me is they drive this section of highway where there's no passing zones at about half the speed that I like to drive it. And it just really bothers me. It honestly does. I can be in the middle of thinking some deep thoughts about a message or something I'm doing. All of a sudden, here's this person. Boom. And guess what? I get to have to try to decide whether I'm a Christian or what. It's rough. I just don't love it. God bless you if you do. Okay. So, while I've got a bigger list than this later on, while we have at least some of these feelings, they're not something we deliberately cultivate. They spring from other causes or root problems. Most of us would be more than happy. I sure would be, and I think I'd have a pretty big crowd if I'd ask everybody to come up here that never wants to be angry or frustrated again. We don't get a kick out of it, do we? Be just as glad not to do it. Okay? Now, there's another thing is And I don't want you to raise your hand on this one. I'm not here to embarrass anyone, but think to yourself. Have you ever coveted something? Maybe something your friends have, some ability, some talent, or maybe a vehicle or a job. I don't mind embarrassing myself. I really have nothing to hide. I have. I actually have. Maybe another one we could stick in there is lust. It's another one I've struggled with in my life. You know, the interesting thing about that, and I'll cover some of these a bit more later, but when you give in to covetousness, when you give in to lust, does it fulfill the appetite that led you to desire that? You know, it never does. It never did for me. Actually, I'll tell you what it does. It increases my appetite, right? It takes more and more and more. It's like drinking salt water. Thank God I've never experienced this, but I've been told that if you're out in the ocean, you know, water is fairly salty, and a small amount won't hurt you, but if you're there, you can't drink a vast amount of that water. And so you're on a lifeboat, like years ago, in the wooden ships, your ships sink. You're out there on a lifeboat, surrounded by water, but if you drank that water, you would actually die faster than if you just went thirsty. Because the more you drank, the thirstier that salt in the water would make you, and it would build up your salt content into your blood till you were just drinking more and more, till it would actually kill you quicker than dehydration. Can you imagine that? And that's what following the natural desires outside. God has given us natural desires. And a bit more on that later as well. And they some of those serve a wonderful place. At the same time, when they're indulged in improperly, they only create a huge appetite that runs away with us. You know, those natural desires, at the time we're tempted, seem to be so easily fixed by indulgence. Only when we indulge, we find that they're not only insufficient, but they actually increase the appetite. Okay, so let's go back to our tree. I hope that's clear enough for you. I'm sorry if you can't read it. Some of you boys are in that corner. I know that's pretty rough. I vacated a seat if any of you need that one, but I hope you can see it best you can. If not, let me know if you want to see it better. Okay, let's go back to this. So I want to use the analogy of a fruit tree. You know, just as it takes a healthy root to have healthy fruit, so unhealthy feelings and attitudes in my heart come from unhealthy roots that I allow in my life. I'd like to clarify this in that this subject of root sins is not original with me. In fact, the Catholics have been teaching about root sins for quite a while, and some others probably just as long. The problem is their teaching, I feel, is rather inaccurate. At the same time, it kind of did inspire me to do a search on my own, so I don't want to take credit for an idea that is not mine in that way. But in studying this and just looking at Scripture, by the way, the Catholics came up with three. Some other fellow that did some research on this had, I think it was either 8 or 9. I didn't agree with his any better. So I just decided to do my own study. At this point, I have come up with 5 root sins. And I'm not trying to, again, I'm not saying I'm exhaustive. Like I told you last night, wisdom's not going to die with me. But this is what I use. Each of the root sins, I would like to also say, each of the root sins has a corresponding uprooting work of God. In other words, each root sin, God wants to take that out of our life. And there's a corresponding work of God. And then there's also a root of faith that we need to transplant the root sin with. Now, I don't think you would really like me if I would take time to cover all that tonight, so I'm going to focus on the root sins a little bit more. And I'm not really sure the week is long enough to do all this either. So I would like to challenge you. If anybody here that wants a challenge and needs something to do in your personal devotional life, why don't you see if you can come up with, I'll give you the root sins tonight. Why don't you see if you can come up with the corresponding uprooting work of God and then the root of faith that God wants to put in there instead. And then email me that list. I would love to see if it matches the one I have, okay? So if you need a challenge there, you got one. Okay, so like I said, I've come up with 5. So we'll just do it this way. Skipped one there, didn't I? We'll use the same tree. Okay, so we have root sins. So we're talking about the things that are in our heart that other people don't necessarily see. The first one I have is pride. Pride. Probably be best if I just read some of these. I want to cover this, some of this fairly rapidly for you. So Psalm 101, verse 4 and 5 says, "A froward heart shall depart from me. I will not know a wicked person. Whoso privately slandereth his neighbor, him will I cut off. Him that hath an high look and a proud heart, I will not suffer." Very strong words about pride. And guess what? I went through the Bible and did a study on pride. I should have checked again, but I think I have 5 sides of pages, fairly like font 4 on my computer, or 12 on my computer. So 5 sides of pages on verses that mention pride. And it's always negative. There's never a positive pride, okay? So God says He's just not going to tolerate pride. And you know, here's, I think I'll throw this in. I forgot my one paper, so this might take a bit of doing, but I think I can do it. So a person who has the root of his pride in his life has feelings. He feels like this, even though he won't often tell you this. He has feelings of superiority, sometimes high self-worth, exceptionalism, a desire for recognition, exalting of self in comparison to others. Others are just as bad or worse, are some things he'll say. On the flip side, he also, a proud person, will also show pride by having feelings of worthlessness. Nobody cares, nobody understands. I never measure up. Nobody is as bad as I am. Interestingly, those all spring out of the root of pride. Now, if you're friends with one of these people, you would describe a proud person this way. You'd say, oh, they have haughty attitudes, or they have high or low self-esteem. Maybe they brag, they put others down, they're impatient, they search for confirmation. Often pride is accompanied actually by moral failure, spending beyond one's means, exclusive friendships, cliques is another word we use, critical spirit, doing things to attract attention, worrying about what others think, and anger problems. Pride, a terrible sin, isn't it? But I think if we're all honest, well, I shouldn't say that, if I'm honest, there's more pride here than what I like. I know that. You look into your own heart and take care of that. Okay, there's a verse in 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 9 through 11 I'd like to read in relation to this. If you want to, you're welcome to turn to that one. It says this, "But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition." Then he says this, "For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows." Then he says this, "But thou, O man of God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, and meekness." Now that's odd. How can love of money, now he says all, actually if I did my research right, that may be just a bit of a mistranslation. I don't think the Greek actually said all necessarily. It's included in all sin. But the love of money, what really, is it just liking what money can do for me? You know, it's not really the physical love of money. It's what I can do with that money. Maybe it's pride. I can buy this vehicle or that house, or I can use it to promote myself in a proud way. The other way, it could also be for selfishness, which is the next root sin. But you know, it's not the money itself, but it's the reason I want the money that makes it a root. You follow me? Okay, so the next one I have is selfishness. It's interesting, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 24 actually gives us the reverse of selfishness, but so in that way it puts, speaking of selfishness, says this, "Let no man seek his own, but every man and others' wealth." And wealth here does not mean that I am necessarily out trying to make money for you, although if you're my employer, I probably should. But no, what he's talking about here is that I am concerned about your good, your well-being, especially spiritually. So let no man seek his own, but every man and others' wealth. You know, a selfish person just can't do that. So let's look at some traits of a selfish person. Like I said, I have to scroll through this. Okay, a selfish person. Oh my, maybe this is mixed up worse than I had hoped. Okay, here, I think I've got it. What matters most is how I feel. Everything else is relative except me, myself, and I. As long as I get what I want, the rest just doesn't matter. That's how a selfish person feels on the inside. If you're friends with a selfish person, you'll say this about them. You'll say they're self-focused, they're impatient, they're unfeeling, they're uncaring, they're easily angered. Again, it's accompanied by moral sins, and they have no thought for how their actions and their words affect others. That's a selfish person. Okay, the next root sin I have is rebellion. We'll read just one verse out of First Samuel, isn't it? First Samuel chapter 15, verse 22 and 23, the first part says, "And Samuel said," this is speaking to Saul, "Hath the Lord as great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken than the fat of rams." Then he says a very powerful thing about rebellion, "For rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness as iniquity and idolatry." I hope none of us here tonight would go out and get involved in witchcraft or idol worship. But yet he says, for me to have a rebellious attitude is as the sin of witchcraft and stubbornness as iniquity and idolatry. Wow! What a statement. Okay, so let's see. Let me describe what a rebellious person feels in his heart. Okay, a rebellious person is resistant to any requirement from authority. Defiance and rejection of those who would guide or direct my actions. A desire to control my own life. An unwillingness to hear or conform to outside input and or pressure. And this often expresses itself in, "Let me alone. This is my life." Makes me think of a young man again. A couple weeks ago, one of my friends was telling me about. He's 18. And he decided he didn't like the restrictions in mom and dad's home. So he just decided he was going to move out. He was in the process of moving out. And the friend was trying to get him to reconsider. And he wondered if I'd try to talk to him. And I tried, but he wouldn't talk to me. He did text me for a while there. And, talk about getting bricks thrown at you first off, I got a brick thrown at me because I didn't put my name on the first text. And then when I told him who I was, then he didn't like that any better. And you know, that's how a rebellious person does. It's just throw everything. Just, you know, don't touch me. Let me alone. I made up my mind. And then he said, "You just made me feel like," and then he used a word I won't use, "nothing really," or "trash." Well, really, I hadn't even said it all that much. You know, it was all coming from the inside, and he was really showing himself up. Okay, so if you've got to deal with a rebellious person, you'll probably say this about them. You'll say they're disobedient. They don't conform to rules. They classify all authority as self-serving. They're quick to justify and be defensive of self, just what I mentioned. They cannot see the viewpoint of others, and they attack those who seek to restrain or give direction. Okay, now, to the fourth one, bitterness. Oh, bitterness. None of you would ever be bitter, right? Well, let me read a verse in Hebrews chapter 12, verse 14 and 15. He says this, follow peace with all men, and holiness without which no one shall see the Lord, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness springing up trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. I hope I'm not being too blunt here, but like I told you last night, I tend to be blunt, so I'm going to go ahead and just be blunt. You know what? If we could get rid of all pride and bitterness in our churches, I think they'd be quite a bit different than they are sometimes. And I'm saying that talking of myself, first of all. Between those two root sins, I was reading through Proverbs. And I wish I should have wrote that verse down, but it says that without pride, contention will cease. You know, how can we have divisions? How can we have fights if there's no pride and there's no bitterness? Okay, let me describe a bitter person. Let's see here, sorry. This thing keeps, sure not as handy as my sheet of paper, but we'll try this. Okay, a bitter person has an unforgiving attitude. Oh, let's see, I think I started on the wrong list, I'm sorry. Okay, bitterness. A bitter person does this, manifests itself in his own heart this way, a detestation and rejection of another or others, a continual harping and recollecting of the action of another, a prejudging of the present people and circumstances by past experiences, an inability to move beyond and or forgive, a need to continually rehash that which has transpired. I'd like for you to judge just a little bit something. I'll talk about a community many, many miles from here. But 30 years ago, in this community, roughly, give or take. I'm not going to tie it down. I don't want you to figure out where I'm talking about because this has happened different places. There were some church struggles. And so instead of one church in this community, it's not a big Mennonite community like what you have here, there's two. They're about 5 miles apart. And it was interesting. The ones that went through that experience, 30 plus, more or less, years ago, are still very, well, let's just say it's still raw. It's just not taken care of. There's still a wound there. But what really bothered me even almost more than that is what it's doing to people my age and younger. Is they see this, and they in turn let maybe something that sure looks like bitterness pass on to them, but guess what? Their bitterness is not directed at the same place. And then the leaders wonder what's going on. You know, I can't expect to have bitterness in my heart and expect my children not to return the favor someday. It just doesn't work. Bitterness is a root, and it destroys many. It destroys many. Okay, again, if you're dealing with a bitter person, which is a very unpleasant experience, they will have unforgiving attitudes. They will base present conclusions and opinions on negative experience in the past. They will be critical of others. Doesn't matter who it is, really. They will readily take the worst possible view of others. No time for explanation. You did. It's all your fault. A focus on myself and how I've been hurt. Oh, you, how they did me so wrong. A desire for revenge. Or, well, Mennonites don't want revenge, do they? But we don't mind if, yeah, see, I told you that's what would happen. A lack of trust, anger, and often accompanied by depression. Okay, to the last root sin here on this list is unbelief. Hebrews 3, verse 12. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief. Paul, whoever wrote Hebrews here was not speaking to non-Christians. Notice he says, brethren, take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief. In departing from the living God, Hebrews 11, 6, but without faith it is impossible to please Him. For he that cometh to God must believe that He is. We'll stop there. You know, unbelief is so vital, yet so easily lost in the confusion and fear that the enemy inserts into our lives when possible. There'd be one further thing on unbelief. I think it's sometimes almost the harder one to deal with, even for a sincere person. Because so often the devil will come as a roaring lion or as an angel of light, and he creates a tremendous amount of confusion. He has in my life, he has in my wife's life, and it's been something we've had to work through, and I don't think it stopped with just us. Unbelief. You know, this thing of just needing to go and trying to do the work of the Spirit, basically in our own life. You rehash, you go, no peace, no rest, you're fearful, you're struggling, you never can say the right thing, and then, anyway, it just goes on and on. And I really don't have time for a whole message on that. Here, let me just read the description of a person who struggles with unbelief here yet. Let's see. Okay, a person who struggles with unbelief will have doubts, fears, distrust, paralysis. They can't move ahead in life. And they will often say or express or at least think this, God doesn't care, understand. He doesn't love me. God made it too hard to live for Him. The Bible, well, of course we wouldn't say this, but the thought is there. The Bible's not true, at least not some of it. I can never live up to God's commands. There's no power in Christ. If I can't understand it, if it doesn't match how I feel, it's wrong. And if you're working with an unbelieving, somebody who struggles with unbelief, you often describe them as this. You'll say they have an inability to trust God and others. They're fearful of the future. They have a dependency and a reliance on self. Skeptical of others, what others have experienced. In fact, I have one young man that struggled with unbelief. He told me that, I just don't believe it. Well, that thing that you say that God has worked in your heart and life, it's just not true. I haven't experienced it, so therefore it's not true. See, he bases everything on his own experience. My experience, nobody else's experience matters, simply what I've experienced. Okay? skeptical of others' experience, distrustful of love and compassion. In fact, they're like, you try to love an unbelieving person, they'll be like, hey, what do you want from me now? Got something else up his sleeve, just trying to hurt me again. Okay, so enough on the root sins. I need to move on here. The natural desire sins, let's look at those a bit. And those I compare to the trunk of the tree, because in other words, they're necessary. I should say they're necessary. Yes, in a way, God has given almost all of us anyway these natural desires. And we have self-focus, covetousness, gluttony. So let's start with self-focus. I would like to differentiate between a self-focus and selfishness this way. It's different from the root of selfishness in that it's a response rather than a dedicated, planned action, okay? If I would just come and smack one of you, there's a chance that depending on what your training and stuff is, you would smack me back. And that's self-focus. You naturally take care of yourself. You'd have no problem taking care of yourself, right? Selfishness is if you come smack me 2 weeks later. You sat there, you thought about, man, Joe needs punch, so okay, he's going to get it. That is selfishness, whereas self-focus is that instant response I have when I'm confronted with something that's distasteful, something that doesn't work. So it's a response rather than a dedicated planned action, okay? Ooh, excuse me. So the next one is covetousness. I know some people feel like I should have this on the root sins, and I'll just tell you why I do not. Covetousness in and of itself works like this, at least in my experience, is, okay, so I have a friend that maybe buys a new truck, let's say. And so I see my friend's new truck, and it's nothing wrong with liking a new truck for us guys especially. You know, hey, that's a nice truck. And I can actually rejoice with him that this was God's plan for him, that this was worked out, that he could have this truck, right? It's that feeling that comes after that that's wrong. As soon as he's gone, like, it just ain't fair. I work twice as hard as he does. Life just don't treat me right. Why can't I have a new truck? See, it goes from actually something that's all right in and of itself, joy, appreciation of something, into something that's negative. So that's covetousness, and that's why I have it as natural desire. It starts off okay, but it turns into something else. Okay, gluttony, and by the way, gluttony, and I should clarify here, I'm not aiming this at overweight people necessarily. It's something I think we all face with, in a way. Gluttony is not just food. Somehow that's got connected with food, and it includes that. But gluttony is indulgence in good and even needful things in a wrong and harmful way. We all need to eat, so let's connect it to food since it is. We all need to eat. There's nothing wrong with eating. But when eating becomes the focus rather than life, if you will, I'm just eating and I eat because I can and it tastes good. That's gluttony, okay? You can do that in a host of different ways. You can be, in a way, the rich man that we're told about in the Bible is going to tear down his barns and build bigger for no other reason than that he wanted to promote self, was gluttony in riches. Okay, we could go on, but I'll let that one for now. The next one I have is a desire for acceptance and belonging, and this is outside of Christ. I want to clarify. Like I told you a little while ago, all of us are built with a desire to be accepted and belong. Why is there, just tell me, why is there all these, you can just go on and on. There's all these sports organizations, there's all these interest organizations. Everybody wants to belong to something or somebody. God made us that way. That's not wrong. But when it's my driving force, when it's the primary thing I pursue, is acceptance and belonging to organization, to other people outside of Christ, it becomes wrong. It's a natural thing that God put in me, and it serves a good purpose. I'm glad my daughters want their dad's confirmation and love, right? But there comes a time that they have to realize that God's acceptance is way more important than dad's acceptance. And anyway, got another message on that, but we'll see where this goes. Okay. Then the last one is lust, and I'm not sure, I should probably clarify this one a bit. As you see there, I have lust clarified or explained as a desire to possess and a desire to attract attention and fascinate. And there's a right way, again, to desire. And I'm thinking especially if God has made us as men and women. There's a proper way. God has put that desire, let's just talk to the men, to possess, to admire in a way. And that's not wrong in and of itself. And the same way for the other side. He has a made the ladies to want attention, They want to fascinate. And again, that's not wrong. It was put there by God for a proper place and time. But when I try to possess or I try to attract attention and to fascinate outside of marriage, it becomes very wrong. And I'll tell you, lust somehow, again, is kind of like one of those things of gluttony. We generally have one-track minds when we mention lust. But you know, I think they're both irrevocably tied together. It's just as much lust for what? A desire to possess, as well as lust to desire and attract attention and fascinate when it's not the proper time in the proper way. Okay, so again, these are areas probably all of us struggle at least in some of these. But when we yield ourselves to God and root out the root sins, these things, even though they're natural, they'll still be there. Please understand me, they'll still be there. The battle to manage these becomes possible, I'm going to say. And let me describe it like this. Let me go back to that young man I mentioned. Okay, so in some of the work, we do actually have a chart with all this wrote out. It's a little easier than maybe having me describe it all. So, like I told you, I wanted a friend when I was done, not an enemy, and I prayed about it, and like I said, I'm not saying this is the only way to do it by any means. But in this situation, we used this chart, and I said, I kind of explained what I had just been explaining to you, not quite as much detail, and let him look at this chart, and God worked. I'll say God worked, because guess what? He looked over that chart, and he said, I know what's wrong with me. I said, okay, what is it? He said, I'm proud. And you know, it's a whole lot easier to let him tell me he's proud than for me to tell him that he's proud. Because now I still have a friend. Still do. And the interesting thing is, while the battle's not over, he's still fighting that battle of that natural desire, and to keep it in its God-given place and its God-given way. He has had victory I don't think he's experienced before because of the work of God in rooting out pride in his life. And I just simply give that to help you understand, again, why I approach this way. Okay. Now we got to get to the top of the tree, and it's time to move on. So we have the fruit sins. Okay, so by calling some fruit sins, I'm not excusing them, please understand me. I'm just saying that these things come up. They work their way from the root sins up through, and then they pop out as a fruit, and they're like, whoa, where'd that come from? Well, it came out of the root. So let's look at what some of these fruit sins are. We have frustration and anger. I mentioned some of the roots that those could come from. So when you see an angry person, well, let me get them all up here and then I'll go back. So with frustration, anger, we have a critical spirit, worry and fearfulness, doubts and confusion, seeking confirmation, impatience and resentment, high or low self-esteem. We have boasting, discouragement, depression, self-righteousness or self-righteous spirit, unwise spending. And miserly, I thought I should clarify that. In my experience of working with people, I have yet to meet one miserly person, but I have met a few that have an obsession with thrift. So if you like that better, go ahead. And then untruthful or lying, stretching the truth, maybe totally fabricating stories. Okay, all these are fruits that spring from an undealt with and unsurrendered, that's actually not a word, not surrendered roots. That's okay. Let's just start with anger, or maybe you can start with frustration. That's probably maybe a nicer word, huh? Not quite as hard to be frustrated as to be angry, is it? So either one, suit yourself. But okay, let's just use anger since I started with that one. It's easy to see an angry person like, whoa, you're angry. That isn't good. You'd better not be angry. And that's often what an angry person is told. It's not good to lose your temper. I'd like for you to guess what? I have yet to meet an angry person that actually doesn't know that he shouldn't get angry. They know that good and well. Or at least for the most part, that's something their own conscience can tell them. You know, they know that anger isn't right. They know that anger's not good. Yet they find themselves powerless. They find themselves unable to control that anger. Like I mentioned, a young man that struggled with anger, he told me, yeah, he said, when I was really in the middle of that battle, he said, I would just fly off the handle, I'd beat up people. And he said, now I've got a younger brother that's struggling with some of the same things, and he says, I tell Dad, I wasn't that bad, was I? And Dad says, oh yeah, you were worse. See, we kind of protect, we kind of build these things and try to hide ourselves from ourselves, but really, then he knew it wasn't right to be angry. He didn't need to be told that, but it just, there was no power in his life. Another way I've seen this done is we could skip over to the other side there on depression. You know, a depressed person might be told, God loves you. You know, you should be depressed. Just snap out of it. Get over it. Jesus died for you. Well, again, a depressed person knows, at least in our circles, knows all that in their head. But there's no connection to their heart. Yeah, God loves you. What does that mean? How does that change the feeling I have? It's not like anyone I've ever met enjoyed depression. Okay, so when we realize that these things, this big list I have up top, and there's many more, could have different nuances there. When we realize that these things are coming out of roots that have not been dealt with, it helps us deal, at least me, with those roots. You know, as those roots are dug up, that root of pride, that root of bitterness, that root of unbelief is dug up and replaced with a work of faith, I find, often to my astonishment, that the fruit sins that were produced by that root disappear as well. Not saying without work, I want to be very careful, and I also want to say that I'm not preaching a doctrine where you do this once and it's done, okay? That root of bitterness can come sneaking back. All of a sudden I realize I've got a weed. I've got to deal with it again, okay? Please understand me. There's no formula. There's no way. To think of one couple that I know quite well. And they were struggling a bit. And, you know, that poor young lady, the wife especially, she was just wishing there would be some program that she could go through that would just take care of problems. You know, it just doesn't work that way. Those roots creep back in. At the same time, deal with the roots. So often we fool around on the surface and we knock the fruit off the tree and say, ha, took care of that. No, you didn't. It'll be back there tomorrow. As long as that root of pride, that root of selfishness, that root of rebellion, that root of bitterness, that root of unbelief are there. And one other thought I would like to let with you, I really don't know how past, present, future, you as a congregation, what you face with this. And I don't have time to go into it, but let me ask you one question. Is as we as congregations, when we find ourselves disciplining a part of the body for sin, do we do it because of a fruit that we see? Or do we do it because somebody's unwilling to deal with a root? I realize, don't get me wrong. Often the root is known because of the fruit that it bears. So it's not that we can't say there's a need in your life, brother, because you've got this fruit in your life. That's correct. That's proper. At the same time, just telling somebody that you're an angry person, we're going to have to deal with you if you don't get over your anger, is like telling a cancer patient, hey, you got cancer. Fix yourself. We need to walk with that person, help them understand what the root issue is. Now, unfortunately, like that rebellious young man I told you about that was leaving home, he went ahead and left. His parents pleading, his friends pleading didn't do any good. And you can never force it. They can still make their decisions and we still have to deal with it accordingly. At the same time, when we deal with people, are we trying to help them see the root that is bringing forth this fruit? Or are we just simply focusing on the fruit and saying get rid of that and while all kinds of bad roots are hidden underneath the ground? Okay, what fruit is your life producing? What root does this fruit in your life spring from? You know, have you dealt with the evil roots through the uprooting work of Christ so that the righteous roots can grow? That's God's desire for me, and that's His desire for you as well. Let's stand for prayer.